From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
All options are on the table.
No option can be taken off the table.
Anybody that would suggest that we should take anything like this off the table in order to deter that kind of event in the United States isn't fit to be president of the United States.
And I said I wouldn't take the option off the table.
No, well, yes, you said
on the table. It's a phrase we've been hearing a lot this summer from the president and the presidential candidates. This week, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama had a public spat over whether or not nukes should be on or off the table. And in June, all of the Republican candidates, except Representative Ron Paul, agreed that using a nuclear bomb against Iran to stop it from developing nuclear bombs must remain a viable option, or on the table. But what does that phrase really mean, and what are its consequences? James Walsh is a research associate in international security at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He says we should expect to hear much more about the table in the months to come.
If WMD was the language phrase of 2003, on the table has to be the foreign policy phrase of this election year. This table has magical properties. Once you're on the table, nothing can ever be taken off.
So has the rhetoric been noticeably different among the Democratic candidates?
Absolutely not. The Democratic side has also endorsed the table. One exception came last week when Senator Barack Obama, he said he would take the use of nuclear weapons off the table in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he was immediately criticized in a New York Minute by his chief rival, Hillary Clinton. She's trying to paint him as being inexperienced and naive, and she used this as an occasion to say, well, I wouldn't make any statements about the use or non-use of nuclear weapons in a general way.
So I understand you can give a concise summary of the rules currently in place for the creation and use of nuclear weapons. Can you really do that?
We have the system in place, the nuclear nonproliferation regime, and we have a bargain. And part of the bargain is most countries of the world agree not to get nuclear weapons. And the ones that get to keep them for a while, like the U.S., Russia, France, and China, one of the things they promise not to do is go around threatening countries who don't have them. You're really only supposed to use nuclear weapons, according to the International Court of Justice, to deter a nuclear attack from another government.
You're saying that in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, there are rules about rhetoric, not just about the use of nuclear weapons?
Well, when you threaten nuclear weapons, that is a form of use of nuclear weapons, at least in the nuclear world. If you go around telling a country, if you don't do what I tell you to do, I'm going to nuke you, that's considered crossing the line. But you would never guess that from listening to the presidential candidates.
Isn't it just part of the training of a politician to keep the deterrent power of nuclear weapons strong by not invoking phrases that take them off the table?
U.S. policymakers take things off the table all the time. I think in this case, the question is, are you tough or not? And those who seek to be tough want to keep everything on the table and then try to turn around and say to the others, oh, you're not tough enough, you're inexperienced. When really, that has no relationship at all to the real world. If anything, when you go around saying, oh, yeah, I consider using nuclear weapons, that has consequences.
Give me an example of the consequences.
If I'm Iran, and then someone comes out and says, well, you know, the next president of the United States, if it's a Republican, he's promised that he would consider using nuclear weapons against us. We better not make Saddam's mistake. We better go ahead and get them now before the next Republican administration so that we can defend ourselves. I think that's a very strong talking point for a bomb advocate in another country.
But is this rhetoric new? I mean, hasn't there been tough talk on this subject pretty much since the Cold War?
The problem is, this is not the Cold War. We live in an age of terror where the whole proposition of nuclear weapons really has to be reconsidered. Earlier in the year, Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State, former National Security Advisor under President Nixon, you had Max Kampelman, a nuclear negotiator for Ronald Reagan. You have Sam Nunn, who was a Democrat, very hawkish, very conservative on issues of defense and national security. These and others have joined together and wrote a very public op-ed earlier in the year saying, wait a minute, if a terrorist gets nuclear weapons, the fact that we have 1,000 or 2,000 isn't going to deter them. These guys, you know, embraced the nuclear age when they were in office and now say in this new set of circumstances, we need to rethink the whole thing.
Those were simpler, happier times, weren't they?
So
in your recent opinion piece, you wrote that keeping all the options on the table, that rhetoric seems to be inevitable from the candidates, but the response from the reporters doesn't have to be inevitable. Are you frustrated by questions unasked?
I am, because the presidential candidates get asked this question, and then they intone with that, you know, resonant voice of theirs and say, all options are on the table. Well, it'd be nice if someone said, well, what exactly does that mean? I mean, is poison gas on the table? Can you take the family members of alleged terrorists and hold them hostage and begin shooting them one by one until a terrorist gives up? I mean, is there anything that's not on the table? And when you say it's on the table, how are these other countries who hear you saying that, how are they supposed to react? I mean, none of those questions get asked. They just get the 10-second soundbite and move on to the next topic.
Wasn't it the president who got the ball rolling on the phrase, you know, everything is on the table?
I think on the table will go down with the word strategery is one of the great contributions to the discussion of national security. You'll remember President Bush, particularly in terms of Iran, was saying he would not take military action off the table. And then, of course, Condoleezza Rice and all the administration officials began to repeat the phrase. And now on the table. I mean, I would like to see this table. This table must be huge, huge table.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Walsh is a research associate in international security at MIT. There was a moment when nuclear bombs were used, not rhetorically, but in fact, and the nation's media were used too. What follows is a replay of an interview we first aired 2 years ago on the 60th anniversary of a wartime milestone. And Bob will take it from here.
In the late morning of August 9th, 1945, United States Air Force Major Charles Sweeney flew a B-29 bomber into the overcast sky above southern Japan. He climbed to an altitude of 28,900 feet and during a break in the cloud cover released his payload, a 10,000-pound atomic bomb codenamed Fat Man, which fell more than a minute before exploding over the port city of Nagasaki.
Atomic explosions as here at Nagasaki caused the prompt surrender of Japan and ushered in the atomic era, perhaps the greatest event of the greatest news year.
One of the era's main chroniclers of the Nagasaki bomb was William L. Lawrence. His 10-part series profiling the bomb would win him and the New York Times a Pulitzer Prize in 1946. Lawrence was never on the ground in Japan, but he had observed the bomb's manufacture and testing and had a bird's-eye view from his perch on a military plane when Fat Man fell on Nagasaki. It was clear that Lawrence benefited greatly from his access to the military. What wasn't known until after the bombs fell was that Lawrence was actually on the payroll of the U.S. War Department. David Goodman wrote about Lawrence in his book Exception to the Rulers, co-authored with his sister Amy. He says Lawrence was well situated to serve the Pentagon.
Lawrence was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. He was a science reporter for the Times. He won his first Pulitzer Prize in 1937, and he became a staunch advocate of the atomic bomb long before the atomic bomb was ever dropped. Throughout the 1930s, he was advocating for research into the use of atomic power, such that he earned a nickname, Atomic Bill.
So when the War Department was looking explicitly for a working newspaperman to help mold public opinion about the bomb, natural choice.
Indeed. General Leslie Groves was the military director of the Manhattan Project, scientists who researched and created the bomb. His own words were that he was looking for a, quote, suitable newspaperman to tell the story of the bomb to the public, to put the language of this arcane science into lay people's terms. So in March 1945, there was an extraordinary secret meeting held at the offices of the New York Times in which General Groves came to meet with William Lawrence and ask that he become a special consultant to the War Department.
David, there is one brief passage in a piece by Lawrence as he flew on the plane that was about to drop the bomb on Nagasaki. Can you read that for me, please?
What Lawrence wrote was that he felt no, quote, pity or compassion for the poor devils who were about to die. When the bomb detonated, quote, awestruck, we watched it shoot upward like a meteor coming from the earth instead of from outer space, becoming ever more alive as it climbed skyward through the white clouds. It was a living thing, a new species of being, born right before our incredulous eyes.
Now, The story goes beyond Lawrence reporting with an obvious conflict of interest about the dropping of the bomb. It gets far more sordid because when the news of radiation disease began to leak out, the War Department went into full defensive mode and used Lawrence to publish, in effect, disinformation. Tell me about that.
General Groves handpicked a group of journalists to accompany him not to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but to the bomb site out in New Mexico, where the first bomb was detonated. And it was there that William Lawrence wrote what General Groves had wanted him to write. Lawrence, quoting General Groves, writes, "The Japanese claim that people died from radiation. If this is true, the number was very small." Lawrence continues in his own editorializing in the story. He writes, quote, "The Japanese are still continuing their propaganda aimed at creating the impression that we won the war unfairly and thus attempting to create sympathy for themselves and milder terms. Thus, at the beginning, the Japanese described symptoms that did not ring true."
60 years later, the dropping of the bomb remains one of the great historical controversies. What I find so stunning about this is that at the contemporaneous moment when the world had to make up its mind, the New York Times, in effect, became a propaganda tool of the U.S. government. And for this, William L. Lawrence and the New York Times were awarded a Pulitzer Prize.
That's right. And the very debate that you allude to about was the atomic bomb an appropriate response? Well, Americans really wouldn't know if they don't know the reality of what happened on the ground. In our book, we call for William Lawrence's Pulitzer Prize to be stripped. I think that this story has some very important modern parallels, certainly in the case of the Iraq War. Any time we see the drums of war, we should really be looking to journalists to challenge those in power, not to become a megaphone for those in power.
David Goodman is co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them.
Coming up, how images make you smoke and help you quit.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, with another reason why reading may be good for your health. We've all seen the lists of side effects listed in magazine ads for prescription drugs, but the ads for products that help people quit smoking should probably disclose one more side effect. Just reading the ad may actually increase your chances of quitting. A new study from Cornell University has found that just seeing the ads for anti-smoking products increases your chances of quitting, even if you never use the product. Alan Mathios, who co-authored the study with Rosemary Avery, Don Kenkel, and Dean Lillard, says public health would improve if the patch pushers pitched more.
The number that we come up with in our projection is that if the pharmaceutical companies increased their expenditures by 10%, we would generate about 80,000 extra quits each year.
Given the public service that these advertisements are providing, maybe the government should be subsidizing the ads, especially if they work against, in some cases, the actual profitability of the company.
That's actually a reasonable conclusion to make. If many people are actually quitting without the use of these products, the ads are generating benefits to society that's not being incorporated into their profit. And so in some sense, these ads are doing exactly what the public health authorities try to do in their advertising and their big campaigns to get people to quit. So then one question is, who's likely to be better at marketing these quit messages? Pharmaceutical firms who are experts in marketing because they market a lot of products, or public health agencies that are sending messages? That's an interesting question as to who's going to be more effective.
All right, you've raised the question. I'm going to ask you to speculate on the answer. Are marketers for products more effective than marketers for good personal behavior?
When you see a advertisement for a smoking cessation product like Nicorette, there's sort of several messages embedded in there. First is the message that you should try to quit. The second message implicit there is that if you're having trouble quitting, there's technologies available to help you quit. And so public health authorities are not likely to point out specific products, they're going to generate messages that say, just stop smoking. That extra information contained in the advertisements by pharmaceutical companies might be the difference as to why they're effective. Now, we didn't do a direct comparison. What we've established is the smoking cessation ads by pharmaceutical companies are effective.
Can you give me an example about products addressing, say, another health problem?
Sure. For many years, health claims for food products weren't permitted by the Food and Drug Administration. Health authorities and the Surgeon General were sending messages that consumers should increase the fiber in their diet. And for years and years, those messages were incredibly unsuccessful. Fiber content in the diet was not going up. And then the regulations changed so that firms could provide disease prevention claims and started a lot of advertising related to the fact that high fiber consumption is related to reduced risks of cancer. When the market was saturated with those ads, it was then that we saw big behavioral changes and more people eating high fiber cereals. And so it was instead of just saying fiber is good for you, actually saying fiber is good for you, here's why it's good for you, and here are the products that contain a lot of fiber. That information together through advertising seemed to engender the behavioral change that the simple message, just increase your fiber consumption, was not able to achieve.
So when it comes to regulation, it sounds as if it would be better if there were less rather than more on these ads.
What's truly ironic in the market for smoking cessation products is print ads for cigarettes with a full-page ad, and in the corner is one of four rotating Surgeon General warnings about the dangers of cigarettes. But it's a pretty small warning. If you see an ad for a smoking cessation product that's still a prescription-only drug, not only do you see the ad, but turn the page in the magazine, and you'll see an entire full page of fine print disclosure talking about the risks of using a smoking cessation product. So we've created a regulatory asymmetry here where it's actually much more expensive to advertise a smoking cessation product if it's prescription only compared with selling a cigarette.
Do you think that the results from your study could be applied to other health issues?
Yeah, one of the big ones right now is statin drug advertising. Statin drugs are the pharmaceutical products that reduce cholesterol in the blood and are shown to be very effective in doing that. One role of advertising is to get consumers to think that they may have high blood cholesterol and get them to the physician. One of the instructions to physicians, however, is that before you prescribe these drugs, they should also recommend therapeutic lifestyle changes such as more exercise and diet. And because of the recommendations to do diet and exercise before prescribing, one of the impacts of advertising, if they get people to see their physician, might be the spillover effects to more positive behavioral changes independent of using the drugs.
That's the bright side. The dark side of these prescription drug ads is that it creates anxiety within people to go get themselves treated for things that don't need to be treated, you know, like toenail fungus, which apparently is not a big problem, but it's a nice expensive drug you get to take every day for 6 months in order to cure it.
Direct-to-consumer advertising is actually quite controversial, and I recognize that. In fact, New Zealand and the United States are essentially the only two countries that allow direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceutical prescription drugs. This is really a question of how well is the physician a gatekeeper to the process. The pharmaceutical companies send representatives to physicians' offices talking about their drugs, giving free samples of their drugs, those types of things. That effort dwarfs the DTC advertising expenditures. And so in the end, the physicians monitoring the system is essentially what we have to depend on whether we allow direct-to-consumer advertising or not.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Alan Mathios is interim dean for the College of Human Ecology at Cornell University.
He allowed this visit as a test. And if I can't stand such tests, I'll lose Tina. And we'll lose each other. Jerry, please help me.
Shall we just have a cigarette on it?
That was Bette Davis in the 1942 cinema classic, Now Voyager. It's likely that Stanton Glantz, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and member of the Screen Out Coalition, would not be moved by the use of a prop so round, so firm, so fully packed. According to that group of scientists and public health experts, smoking in the movies lures 390,000 kids every year to take up the deadly habit. We spoke with Glantz this past March. He told us that the health risks of secondhand cinema smoke are no longer debatable.
There's about 100 scientific studies of the effect of smoking in the movies on kids. And what all of this evidence says when you put it together is that kids who see a lot of smoking in the movies are about 3 times more likely to actually start smoking than kids that don't see a lot of smoking in the movies.
And your group is suggesting a 4-part solution.
One is that new movies with smoking in them get an R rating. We think that the simple action of treating smoking in the movies the same way that Hollywood treats abuse of language would prevent about 200,000 kids a year from starting to smoke. The second thing we'd like to see is an anti-smoking ad shown before any movie or on any DVD with any movie that has smoking in it, because there's evidence that that ad actually tends to neutralize the pro-smoking effect in the movies without affecting whether or not kids would recommend the movie to their friends. The third thing is an end to all brand identification. There's really no need for it. I mean, one of the directors that I've talked to said that there's actually a person who sits next to him when they're making a film who's in charge of clearances, and he's told not to put any branded merchandise in the film without either a release or a product placement deal. Cigarettes are the only thing where the insurance companies don't require either a release or a product placement deal. And the tobacco companies get out there and they're just shocked that their brands are being displayed in these movies so prominently. And Philip Morris is now even running ads in the trade press urging Hollywood not to display its brands. But if Philip Morris was serious about keeping their products out of the movies, they would just sue a couple of producers for trademark infringement. The fourth thing we're asking for is what I call a certification of no payoffs. You know how at the end of the movies, when they have an animal in the movie, they have a certification that no animals were harmed in the making of the film? Well, we'd like a certification that nobody got paid off for putting smoking in that movie.
You have provided for a couple of exceptions to the list of rules. One would be for a film which is portraying a historical figure, you know, known to smoke heavily, like Edward R. Murrow in Good Night and Good Luck, or maybe Winston Churchill. Another, in the spirit of the old Hays Code, which allowed you to show someone committing homicide as long as he got his comeuppance in the end, allows you to show smoking if it also shows the negative health effects.
Yes. The reason that we included those two exceptions was, frankly, I got tired of hearing about Winston Churchill's cigar. And the fact is that there are very, very few movies, especially the kind of movies that we're concerned about that are mass marketed to teenagers, where, you know, Winston Churchill stomping around chomping a cigar was a big issue. The exception for actual portrayal of the negative effects of smoking was put in there for similar reasons. We heard objections out of Hollywood. Oh, what if we wanted to make a movie showing, you know, that smoking is horrible and kills people, and that would deprive us of the opportunity to educate kids? So we said, okay. So these couple of exceptions that we've allowed were really put in there to just get rid of a couple of fallacious arguments that were being used against us.
There are all sorts of unhealthy behaviors depicted in PG-rated movies, from eating pizza to jumping out of windows onto awnings to fistfights to car chases. I mean, shall we have movies rated R for reckless driving?
Well, the thing which makes tobacco use different from these other things that you're talking about is we have this tremendous science base. And in those other areas that you're talking about, we just don't have scientific evidence that car chases are causing 400,000 kids a year to go out and drive recklessly and get killed eventually.
What's the reaction been from Hollywood?
For the first couple of years, we were completely ignored by Hollywood, and then they were mad and saying all kinds of mean things about us. But there's been a couple areas where there's been some meaningful progress. The Weinstein brothers have now started putting anti-smoking ads on their DVDs. That's something that the Motion Picture Association told me years ago hell would freeze over before that happened. Theaters are now willing to allow state and city health programs to run anti-smoking ads in theaters before movies with smoking in them. That's something else the Motion Picture Association had told me would never happen.
Stanton Glantz is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Since we spoke to him in March, there have been a number of developments in this story. In May, the Motion Picture Association of America announced that it would add smoking as a criterion, alongside violence, sexual situations, and language, in rating movies. So Stan joins us now for an update. Stan, total and absolute victory. Congratulations.
Well, we don't have total and absolute victory, but the thing that we do have is a little bit of forward motion. After 5 years of stonewalling on the part of the studios and the MPAA, they're now recognizing publicly that smoking in the movies encourages kids to smoke, and they're pretending to solve the problem. Now we have to get them to just actually solve the problem.
Well, let's talk first about what the Walt Disney Company has done. They seem to be the most aggressive among the studios.
Well, that's actually not true. What Disney did was announced a policy they adopted 3 years ago in 2004 of, quote, discouraging smoking in their films, and said they would get it out of their Disney-branded films. Since they adopted the policy 3 years ago, we've actually been able to look at the movies they've released since then, and there's been essentially no change in the amount of smoking in the Disney films. The most thorough policy so far was actually adopted by General Electric's Universal, which put in place a fairly systematic review all the way from script approval through production of smoking that's in their movies. That was adopted last April. It's too early to tell how much difference that's going to make, but it still doesn't do none of the studios have done the simple thing of just saying we're not going to make or distribute any films to kids that has smoking in them.
What about the MPAA itself? It has at least paid lip service to changes. Is it just lip service, or are they really being attentive here?
I think so far the MPAA is paying lip service. On May 10th, they announced they would, quote, consider, close quote, smoking in movies when assigning ratings. The first movie that they've rated under the new policy was Hairspray, which they gave a PG, which is a youth rating. And so what we want is an R rating for smoking, so it's left out of films that are marketed to kids. And so far, there's just been no effect of the MPAA's policy. Another interesting sideline on the MPAA is they have issued statistics several times claiming there's a lot less smoking in movies than we're saying. And the 30-some-odd attorneys general have written the MPAA asking them for the backup study that supports the statistics they've been quoting. And so far, the MPAA has simply refused to produce any kind of backup for the claims that they're making.
Of course, I was being ironic when I declared total victory. But, you know, I do have to say that it took decades for environmentalists to, you know, have a whole lot of influence on government or industry, and you seem to have achieved a fair amount in a relatively short time. Are you not encouraged by some of the preliminary actions that Hollywood's making?
Oh, yeah, I'm very encouraged, and I think that within a year or so, we will have gotten them where they need to be, which is to get an R rating for smoking in the movies so that it's not in movies that are being promoted to kids, and also one of the other things, and another place that Disney may have moved forward in a substantive way, is they've agreed to put anti-smoking public service announcements on the DVDs that they're distributing of films that have smoking in them, which is another thing we've been asking for. The big question that is remaining for Disney is, where are they going to get the PSAs? Are they going to get them from someplace like the American Legacy Foundation Truth Campaign, which have been shown to actually reduce smoking? Are they going to go to Philip Morris or some other source and get ads that actually subtly encourage smoking?
Hey, I want to ask you one more thing. Now, with digital technology, it's actually possible to retroactively remove cigarettes, at least cigarette brands, from films. Have you got a position on that? Do you think we should be doing some revisionist cinematic history on, I don't know, Casablanca, for example?
We actually think doing that could actually cause harm. We're trying to solve the problem moving forward. You know, we know that there were a lot of history of payoffs between the tobacco companies and Hollywood going back decades. They did product placement, all this other stuff. We're trying to move beyond that.
Well, Stan, once again, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you and goodbye.
Stanton Glantz is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco.
Between your fingertips, and just like a cigarette, I never.
Coming up, the Olympic torch draws reporters like moths. Is Beijing ready? And the scent of an anchor.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Like a cigarette.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week starts the one-year countdown clock to the first-ever Olympics in China. Opening ceremonies will commence on August 8, 2008, but questions remain as to whether international standards will be met for conditions on the ground, from smog to human rights. This week alone, Reporters Without Borders called for the release of about 100 journalists, cyber dissidents, and free speech activists in China. Human Rights Watch released a report called "You Will Be Harassed and Detained: Media Freedoms Under Assault in China Ahead of the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games." And a group from the Committee to Protect Journalists went to Beijing to release their report titled "Falling Short: As the 2008 Olympics Approach, China Falters on Press Freedom." Jocelyn Ford has reported from China since 2001. She heads the Professionalism Committee for the Foreign Correspondents Club of China. They've just released their second survey assessing whether China is ready to receive some 20,000 foreign journalists to cover the Olympics. Jocelyn, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks.
So let's go back to the first survey a year ago. On what grounds did the survey deem China unready for the world's sporting press?
China has agreed to allow foreign media to come and report freely during the Olympics. And what we found last year was that there were an awful lot of detentions of foreign correspondents. There was a level of violence that is clearly unacceptable. We had one cameraman was sent to the hospital because he was attacked by a security guy for taking a photograph. We had 57 cases of intimidation of sources. One source was paralyzed after he spoke to the foreign media. He was shoved down a slope, and we will never know who exactly did it, but he believes it was the security police who he had spoken to about talking to the foreign media, and shortly after he left them, this tumble occurred.
On the other hand, the new survey says that 40% of the people that you interviewed, the foreign correspondents working in China, think conditions have improved overall.
That's true. Before January 1st this year, every time I wanted to report in another city, officially, I was supposed to go to the local government in that city and ask permission. Now, of course, what happens is if you're going out to cover a protest or a social problem, the local government will say, of course, you cannot come. So we never did that. It was sort of like cat and mouse. We would sneak around the country, watching our backside to see whether there were officials behind us, whether we would be thrown out of the area or not. And that has eased up somewhat.
Do you think it's because it is now really close to the Olympics, whereas last year it really wasn't?
Well, this is very clearly the case. The Chinese government has lifted those restrictions on a temporary basis only through the end of the Olympics. The purpose of hosting the Olympics is sort of like a coming out party. You have a big opportunity to invite the world press to your country and say, look at our achievements, look what we're doing. Well, if they go around and arrest half the reporters or any number, that'll become a big headline and it will not serve their purposes. So they realized, I believe last year, that some change was necessary. In addition, of course, they had already promised the International Olympic Committee that they would allow free reporting of the Olympics, though that was a rather vague, you know, there was nothing specific about what they considered free reporting or what the International Olympic Committee considered free reporting. And let me add here that the International Olympic Committee and all the sponsors, the corporate sponsors of the Olympics, have a lot at stake as well, having the Olympics go well. They do not want to be in a position, I believe, to say, you know, see foreign correspondents arrested and all that sort of stuff. So,
and this event brought to you by Pepsi.
Exactly.
Recently, it was reported in the Sunday New York Times that China had hired Western public relations people to help them with their image problem related to tainted consumer goods. And I just wonder, given this big public relations effort, would part of that perhaps include easing up on the foreign press working in China?
We don't know what these people really think about a freer media, but I suspect that they have not been convinced at all that a free foreign media is in their interest. For the Olympics, I have been told by sources that they may be trying to infiltrate foreign news organizations. They train people who might be able to assist English speakers when they go to the country, or people in other languages. And some of those people may also be reporting on the activities of the reporter they're helping, for example. That happens regularly with us. Our staff is occasionally called in by public security officials to find out what we're up to. But I do not think the government is convinced that a free foreign media is in their interest.
Well, Jocelyn, all I can say then is let the games begin.
Let them begin. And after they end, don't stop watching.
Beijing correspondent Jocelyn Ford. Thanks, Jocelyn.
Thank you.
It's been a busy summer for Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He's been dealing with a global outcry over his nation's nuclear future, denying accusations that Iran is fueling violence in Iraq, and ignoring U.S. protests over the detention of possibly four American citizens on espionage charges. Domestically, his government has imposed a crackdown on political and social freedoms that's been called the harshest in 30 years. The BBC's Francis Harrison arrived in Tehran when the reformers were still in office, before Ahmadinejad's government took power. She spent the last 3 years reporting from Iran. Having completed her assignment, now she's back in London ready to talk about her time as BBC's Tehran bureau chief. Harrison says that when conservatives gained control in Iran, many things changed, including some reporters' wardrobes.
My colleagues who are women journalists immediately started wearing black to go to press conferences because they feared they wouldn't be allowed in otherwise. There's been a lot more in terms of social and political crackdown probably in the last 6 months to a year. Since April, we've seen a pretty serious crackdown on un-Islamic dress as it's viewed by the regime, and a lot of students being put in jail, particularly recently, and anybody who's in any sense a critic of the regime from within, feeling much more endangered now and having court cases, suspended sentences passed against them and so on.
Is there any role for a free press, domestic or foreign, in Iran?
What we've seen in recent months is more of a crackdown by the government, sometimes, of course, interestingly, the judiciary reopening newspapers afterwards. But the vestiges of the reformist media are facing more and more problems. They're trying to change the directors of various news agencies who were pro-reformist. And the foreign media, of course, depend a lot on local sources, on what's printed in the local papers. That space is tightening pretty rapidly.
In the West, sometimes it's very difficult to do a kind of Iranology and figure out who is behind what in day-to-day events there, whether it is the judiciary or whether it's the government, the bureaucracy, or the clerics who hold supreme authority. Is it difficult for you to parse who is behind what in any given news episode?
Yes, it's very difficult because in many countries you have access to the top decision makers and power brokers. You know what they're like as characters. You know their political views. But obviously in Iran, journalists do not have access to the supreme leader, for example, and not that much access to the president. And it's sort of like criminology. It's very difficult, even inside, to know exactly what's happening.
Tell me what it was like just going about your everyday business in this environment, especially in a place where women's place in society is quite restricted.
Well, I mean, I would differ with what you've said, that a woman's place in society is pretty restricted. I mean, when you compare Iran with any Arab country or Afghanistan, Iranian women are more educated and more progressive. University students, at least 65% are women undergraduates. In many government offices, you see a lot more women at the lower ranks than men. And those women will eventually become managers, and then they will shape the future. But having said that, of course, the culture is still quite conservative in many ways, and it's not nothing particularly to do with Islam.
Tell me whether as a woman or just as a Westerner, how difficult it was to get ordinary Iranians to speak to you.
Well, it is increasingly difficult to get people to speak to you openly. But now and again, you get interesting responses, and it's when you least expect it. I remember, for example, doing vox pops on the streets of Tehran when Saddam Hussein had been sentenced, and the headlines were all about a dictator being sentenced to death. And I wondered what people in Iran would have to say about it, given that they'd fought an eight-year-long war against Saddam's forces. And in fact, a couple of people, quite interestingly, said to me, oh, well, what we like is to see a dictator meet his just deserts. Then they would sort of say, well, we hope it will happen in other countries too, sort of nod, nod, wink, wink. In other words, what about the dictators in this country? When will they get what's coming to them? So, you know, you'd be surprised. Sometimes people find quite interesting ways of, subtle ways of expressing what they really think, despite the restrictions, despite the fear, which is increasing.
You did a piece on the BBC website, and it includes a remarkable passage. I'm just going to quote you. It says, people have come to my office with information, and I have found myself warning them to be careful about coming again. It gets to a point where you find yourself questioning the motives of anyone brave enough to speak out. Either it is a trap, or perhaps they are really naive, in which case, why are we interviewing them? Now, that is a complicated environment in which to do any reporting. Tell me more.
Well, a couple of days after I left Iran, the one person I had in mind, who was a student activist who had helped us a lot with stories, he was arrested. And I knew he had a court case the day after I left, and I knew that he was going to have problems, but I wasn't expecting him to be arrested quite so fast. And as far as I know from human rights groups like Amnesty International, he is in solitary confinement, and it's pretty kind of gutting when you think that people you've interviewed who've had contact with foreign journalists, and not only myself, end up in jail. And he's not the only one. There are others. And so when they come openly to your office and you know people are watching, you know, it's my responsibility to say to him, be aware of what you're doing and the risks you're taking. And we, you know, discuss whether it's safe for him to email me, to phone me, whether it's safe to even come. You have to be responsible for people, particularly, you know, people who are quite young, to make sure that they know what they're getting into if they give you an interview.
Well, Frances, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Frances Harrison, the new religious affairs correspondent for the BBC in London, has just returned from 3 years in Tehran. Over the past 20 years, all manner of celebrities have been introducing eponymous perfumes. Actresses, pop singers, athletes, even at least one business tycoon. But till now, one category of fame not so honored is TV news anchors. But could that sorry situation change? Gossip websites have reported that CNN's Anderson Cooper has been approached by designer Tom Ford to have his own brand of cologne that supposedly would be named Coop. Ford's organization told us that the rumors are untrue, but we still wanted to run the idea past Chandler Burr, perfume critic for the New York Times, who joins me now. Chandler, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we've seen celebrity scents before. We've seen Elizabeth Taylor and Beyonce and Celine Dion and Michael Jordan and Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you know what Anderson himself smells like, but what do you suppose journalism smells like?
I mean, journalism would smell sort of like the ink to me. But I think that if I were going to create a perfume for Anderson Cooper, I got to say, I think it would make it an aldehydic. Now, aldehydes are the molecules that are in actually Chanel No. 5 and a lot of other perfumes. And they're synthetic molecules that give you a sort of a beautiful, clean, contemporary, yet classic exterior, sort of seamless, like a coat of armor, as almost as if hiding something. They're certainly commercial. They would say, buy my scent. And they're professional. So they're saying, you can count on my honesty. And yet, they're strangely opaque, sort of saying, well, you can't count on my complete honesty, but we won't get into that.
Okay, no, we certainly will not. When a celebrity of any kind has a scent made in their image, I guess, what decisions are made by perfumers to try to find the personality of the individual?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I just spent a year with Sarah Jessica Parker behind the scenes. She's actually one of the stories about perfume creation of my next book. And I have to say that the process is a fascinating combination of almost putting her on the couch. She had meeting after meeting with them. She talked about what she liked, her memories, her thoughts, the images, and they literally took those and they mated them with scents, accords, raw materials, and that's how you come out with a perfume.
Now, getting back to Anderson Cooper, I have to agree that he doesn't exactly call to mind ink-stained wretch.
No.
But he does project a certain personality, but so do other journalists as well. You know, let's just say the rumor were true and he signed on. Can you imagine who would be signing on later and what their fragrances would smell like?
Well, I think Wolf Blitzer. You've got to have a Wolf Blitzer cologne, right? And you do a vetiver, which is an organic material that's sort of classically masculine, just sort of slightly rough, slightly dirty, but, you know, in sort of a He-Man, not too dirty way, like I'm a guy, but I'm wearing pancake makeup in an air-conditioned set. That's what you do. And now, Keith Olbermann, I think, would be very interesting. You could do a combination of a bitter orange petit grain, which gives you sort of a claws, I'm not to be screwed with type raw, powerful scent, and then you do a sort of a soothing peppermint distillation to make it all sort of smooth and go down nicely, you know?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Now, you mentioned Keith Olbermann. What about his arch nemesis, Bill O'Reilly? What does he smell like?
Bill O'Reilly. Why don't we do a purely synthetic scent for Bill O'Reilly? No naturals whatsoever. And why don't we just base the whole thing on a synthetic civet? That would be great. Civet is a 19th century material taken from, it's sort of a cream from the anal gland of a species of cat. We could do Chris Matthews. Now, that would be interesting. I would base that on a tuberose, which is the loudest, most aggressive, most self-satisfied flower that you can possibly find in the perfumer's palette. It just bursts out of the bottle and basically starts yelling at you. And I would cut it with a cis-3-hexanol, which is a synthetic that smells sort of half like freshly cut grass and half like banana.
Right, you are. Well, Chandler, this has been truly enlightening. I appreciate once again you joining us.
My pleasure.
Chandler Burr is the perfume critic for the New York Times.
The sounds of your life captivate you.
For the regime that was denounced by President Bush to be able to summon the superpower to the conference table is clearly a feather in the cap of the Tehran government. But surely there must be something more involved in this unusual flirtation.
Daniel.
Hear me.
Daniel.
Smell me.
Daniel. Shaw, an incisive fragrance from news analyst Daniel Shaw. At fine retailers everywhere.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson and Rob Christensen are engineers. We had help from Andrea Ambrose and Madeline Elish. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
It's the sound and smell of news.
Support for On the Media is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting Mozart dances by the Mark Morris Dance Group on August 16th. Check local PBS listings. Support for On the Media is also provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.